Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brendan McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical banks of the electronic Charles.
How does Bellevue Hill look this morning?
That's quite lovely.
Yeah.
Quite lovely, yes.
Have you been out hiking on the hill?
Not today, but you know, of course, on many other days, I walk up to the top of the hill near the water tower. Those of us familiar with West Roxbury will know the water tower. I walk up there and I loop around sometimes. Sometimes I walk that walk in the evenings. It's quite lovely.
Now, was it on that walk that you encountered this animal acquiring its meal recently?
Yes, that's where I was at dusk. I was walking up there and I heard a bird screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, wow, what's happening in there? And I looked in and it seemed to me that there was a bobcat eating a wild turkey. And running with the wild, not eating, but running with the wild turkey in its mouth. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, that could that be a bobcat? There are other bobcat now in West Roxbury, over in Millennial Park, which is also in West Roxbury. There's been pictures taken of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this area that is at the top of Bellevue Hill is adjoins a large wood lot and is connected to a rail line. And that's pretty typical of, you know, in other words,
bobcats like to use mass transport.
Yes, they use they use public transportation in the best green fashion. Why? Because they come in when the trains stop running. They run along the train lines and come in from the western suburbs.
Right. Yeah, there were mass bobcat protests when Amtrak was defunded.
Right. Thankfully, the Biden administration is responding to their calls for change.
Wow. So, well, it's good that you bring up turkey, you know, which reminds me of food, which reminds me of breakfast. So what are you having for breakfast this morning?
I am having 3 strips of bacon, a garlic bagel with delicious Irish butter, some red table grapes, and a delicious glass of orange juice.
How about some canned bobcat? No?
No. Okay. No.
Fresh or canned. Well, that sounds typical McConville. I'm a little different.
Actually, though, can I interrupt you for 1 minute there?
Of course you can.
I received my vaccine this week for the first round of the COVID vaccine.
How is this relevant?
Well, I was going to say, I was relieved this morning and wanting to eat that breakfast and not say fly at night and feed on insects.
Oh, okay. All right. So you've suffered
no ill effects.
No zombification yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Not yet. All right. If I notice anything, I'll let you know. Well, yeah, I'm a little depressed today, so I'm going to have not only my iced coffee, which you see me enjoying, but I'm going to have a half a grapefruit for breakfast. And I'm going to have the sausage and eggs and all that stuff too, but I'm going to amp it up. You ever eat a half a grapefruit? You know, you eat them with the little spoon and
I've never eaten a grapefruit.
You got to be kidding me.
No, I have
you
never had
are
one.
The weirdest eater in the history of the world. You've never eaten a grapefruit?
No, I have not.
Oh my goodness. Well, every once in a while, my mom would splurge and buy a grapefruit and cut it in half. And I would eat half a grapefruit for breakfast. That was always a treat at my house. So I'm going to have a half a grapefruit in honor of my mother. And Mother's Day coming soon. So
yes.
Yeah, I'll spend Mother's Day as I have traditionally done, fishing.
Right.
It's the best fishing day in the world because everyone is actually with their mother or with their wives' children.
Right.
So yeah. Anyway, all right. So that's our lighthearted segment for today.
Yeah. Right.
Because
there's not much merriment coming.
No, we're going back to at what you have told me now is the penultimate, which listener means next to last, the penultimate episode on the Troubles in Northern Ireland. This is part 6. We're going to talk about the hunger strikes today, one of the most, maybe the most infamous incidents, one of the most famous, disturbing, terrible incidents, or set of incidents in the Troubles in Northern Ireland. So do you want to set us up so we know the background? And
yeah.
We're around 1980 when we ended the last...
With the death of Lord Mountbatten, when he was killed in County Sligo. It was a decade, of course, the 1970s, filled with violence and despair and atrocities. But in many respects, the worst was yet to come. And the whole conflict was taken to a new level with the outbreak of the hunger strikes by nationalist prisoners, by Republican prisoners in British jails, and the attempted assassination at the end of that period, sort of beyond it, but in response in some respects, the attempted assassination of the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Margaret Thatcher, and the entire top of the British government was an attempted decapitation strike. Again, it reflected the failure to reach any kind of accord or compromise with the parties. The crisis that developed in the early 1980s grew like a number of series of issues and struggles from decisions made really in the mid-1970s. They were not made by Margaret Thatcher. They were made by Harold Wilson, which we talked about in the last episode. Until 1976, internees, remember they were arresting people without trial and interning them. They were allowed, they had what they called special status, which they were basically treated as political prisoners. They were allowed to wear their own clothes. They could conduct classes. They could grow their own food. They, you know, in other words, they had privileges. Incidentally, they arrested them. It shows you just how crazy this whole thing was. When they arrested them and turned them all, they started to hold classes, and the classes were like in guerrilla warfare, how to use explosives while in prison, while in the internment camp.
Were they held in Ireland, Northern Ireland?
In Northern Ireland, yeah.
And they were held in camps.
In camps, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Basically, but they were conducting classes on, like, this is how you start a guerrilla campaign. This is how you, urban warfare. It was crazy. So in March of 1976, the Harold Wilson administration withdrew those privileges for all new people, not the people who already had them, but for anyone who would be arrested thereafter, because in this moment, they had extended those rights to even people who had been convicted of political crimes, had gotten basically the same set of rights. And the Wilson government basically said after 1976, we're not going to do that to people who are prisoners for violent crimes. They're going to be treated as prisoners, mm-hmm. and not as in a special status.
Yep.
This was directed against the Republican nationalist prisoners. There were some loyalist paramilitaries in jail, but it was a tiny fraction compared to the Republicans. It applied to them as well, but it was directed against them. There was an immediate reaction against this change because the provost, and by that point, the INLA, the Irish National Liberation Army, the socialist group, they did not want to be treated like common criminals. And so they were extremely, extremely angry from the get-go that this had been done. And they wanted to, you know, protest somehow. The protest started immediately. It's hard to say. I think that the leadership within the camps, which there was a political structure within the camps, naturally, and in the prisons, there were, in other words, they organized themselves as units in the sense of the paramilitary groups they were part of within the jails. They began to organize protests that ultimately devolved into the hunger strikes. But it was organized and accepted in and out of the prison internment camps and became a formal policy of both the Provisional IRA and the INLA, and was supported by the political parties that were attached to both groups. Protests began in the form of what was called the dirty or blanket protests. There is film of this online. I was looking at some of it today. It is perhaps, except for the starvation itself, some of the most sobering and unpleasant. What they started to do was they said, okay, if you won't let us wear our own clothes, we won't wear any clothes. And then they started wearing blankets wrapped around them, but they wouldn't wear clothes at all because they didn't want to wear prison clothes. You know, in other words, like a criminal.
I see. So the issue was they weren't being allowed to wear their own clothes anymore. They were going to be forced to wear prison clothes. And they said, we won't wear prison clothes. So we'll just wear no clothes and just wrap ourselves in blankets.
Exactly.
Okay.
The national prisoners initially refused to wear prison uniforms. This began in the fall of 1976 when a Provo prisoner named Kieran Nugent refused to wear a prison uniform. He was soon joined by others in the Provos and members of the INLA. They were acting together. They were both part of the Republican movement, although outside, of course, there was a lot of tension between the Provos and the INLA at times, and there also between the INLA and the original IRA. Soon a significant number of Provo prisoners were either going naked or wearing blankets. They were demanding to be allowed to go back to the former conditions, these so-called special conditions of political prisoners, and they refused to wear any kind of garment that marked them as a common criminal. It went on for several years. It was going on. It was centered in the Mays prison, which was a sort of super high tech or supposedly super secure Republican prison, not just for Republicans, but in other words, super secure prison in Northern Ireland designed to, sort of control these political prisoners. That was the core of it. And in fact, most of the action was there, so to speak. This went on for several years. It began to intensify in 1978 when the blanket prisoners began to refuse to wash or use their chamber pots and began to smear their excrement on the walls of their cells and all around them on the floors and the walls of the cell. There's pictures of this online. You can go on and see what it looked like.
I don't understand. I don't.
For months
like
at a time.
Punishing yourself rather than punishing the people who are.
They felt like it was the only way they had to strike back. And if you want to put it that way, they made it almost impossible for prison officials to enter the cells because it was so disgusting. You know, in other words, so revolting. Amazingly, the press was not paying attention to this. And, for most of the time, this was going on.
Was it an intentional blackout? Were they suppressing it?
There was mention of it, but I think that there wasn't, the sort of sense of where it was all going. And so they sort of didn't put the focus on it. Also, the British press covered, of course, things in Northern Ireland in a certain way that prevented attention necessarily being paid to certain things.
What about the Irish press? I mean, the
they covered it. They did cover in the Republic. They did cover it, and there was attention to it, but I don't think they saw where it was going. This began to change in 1979 when several Catholic clerics, including the Archbishop of Armagh, visited the Mays and other prisons and denounced the conditions there, even for prisoners who weren't on the strike. And then also just said, look, this condition with these people has to be changed. Obviously, they're not like other prisoners. You have to have some kind of accommodation with them. They refused. The British authorities refused to bend at this point. Several Irish and Northern Irish and British news services began covering what was happening in the Mays prison at that point in a very serious way.
Because of the high profile of the Archbishop, high profile visit by the Archbishop. Okay.
Right. Drew their attention. They began to look at the conditions overall in the prison, its nature, and also the condition of these dirty or blanketed prisoners. The demands of the prisoners seemed relatively minor. They basically had 5 points. They wanted to be allowed to dress, to have visitors, dress in their own clothes, have visitors, conduct educational classes. It was pretty basic, but the British government did not want to give it. Of course, it was taking a conservative turn. That was coming into the Thatcher years. The government had begun to take a conservative turn. Most of them, the demands seemed minor, but the conditions had so deteriorated that it seemed like to a lot of the press that it was building towards a crisis, although people, I don't think, still didn't believe that they could see where it was going. It was at this moment that Bernadette Devlin, who we had talked about in the earlier episodes, who had been involved in the rioting in Derry and played a role as a kind of free-floating radical Republican, although not part of the Sinn Féin or the Provost, she was at that point already married. She became a kind of spokesperson for the movement to end the treating the Republican prisoners and under the slogan of smash the H block, which the H block was within the Mays prison. And the sort of smash the H block became the slogan of those who were resisting this change in their treatment. She became a kind of spokesperson for it. And it began to attract global attention because she was a global figure. We're coming up on our first break. We'll be right back with the historians.
Demoulas Supermarkets, under the trade name Market Basket, is a chain of 80 supermarkets in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Maine. Demoulas Supermarkets, Market Basket, more for your dollar.
This is Mike Janity. Join me every Wednesday afternoon from 12 noon to 2 p.m. for DJ Mike Janity's Disco Dance Party on WNTN.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. Things are getting very bad with the prisoners in Northern Ireland. It's Brendan. Are we still in the early 80s now?
We're still in the early. We're just
late 70s. Late 70s.
We're at 1980. We're basically 1980. At 1980 now.
Okay.
Sometime in 1980, the prisoners in the maze began to consider declaring a hunger strike and to understand why they chose this particular weapon. I think we have to go back deep into Irish history and the history of Irish republicanism. Despite the perception in America and much of the world that this was a unique thing, in fact, Irish prisoners had done this before. It was part of Irish Republican political culture.
When had they done it before?
Yeah, for political purposes. Some people, if you look it up online, which I had gone online and I looked at this, and some people were saying, oh, this tradition goes back to medieval times in Ireland, the people doing this. But I think it really does, in a modern sense, a person I was friendly with in Ireland in the mid-1980s called this, he said, this is the nuclear weapon of Irish politics. I'm going to starve myself. That is how it came to be. Again, you could make a lot of cultural references. You could make a cultural references to the Irish famine, you know, that people see, which will eventually at some point we'll probably do episodes on. Mm-hmm. But it had been used in since the time of the unrest against the British at the time of the Irish War of Independence.
Okay.
And of course, other people in other cultures used it. But in Ireland, people showed a strong willingness to starve themselves to death to make their point. In fact, between 6 and 12 prisoners associated with Republican movement starved themselves to death in either British prisons or British prisons in Ireland at the time of the Irish War. You know, the turmoil really begins in 1917, going forward to 1921.
So it was 60 years previous. It's within the memory of some living people at the time around 1980.
Right. It's definitely within living memory. Between 6 and 12 of them starved themselves to death, several in the Cork jail, several in jails on the British mainland, in other words, in Great Britain. They starved themselves to death. This is acknowledged by Irish scholars and Irish people, generally politicians, but what's not acknowledged is that during the Irish Civil War, when the Free State government, which was the government that accepted the treaty with the British that divided the country, when they were at war against the IRA, the sort of left-leaning IRA that had rebelled against them and Sinn Féin, 8,000 people went on a hunger strike that they had interned. 8,000 out of the 12. Yeah. So that was all, so many numbers were involved that people's families could remember. My family member went on a hunger strike. There had also been a hunger strike in 1972 when the Provo prisoners wanted to get the same rights that the people who were interned were, these special rights. They had used a hunger strike as a weapon there.
All and right, they had so gotten it really was a tradition here.
Yeah, there were 40 provos on that hunger strike in 1972. 40.
Did any of them die, Brendan?
No, none of them died because the government gave in and gave them, you know, allowed them to dress in civilian clothing rather than watch them starve themselves to death. In 1980, some Republican nationalist prisoners in the maze, provos and members of the INLA, they went on a hunger strike in 1980. Seven of them. When they called for this hunger strike in the maze prison, these seven guys, they were led by a guy named Brendan Hughes, who I've talked about in the earlier episodes as well. He was a very serious member of the IRA, Provo. But when they called for volunteers, 150 people volunteered. Seven were chosen. It was supposed to be representative of going back to the rebellion in 1916. It had a significance. It was tightly organized. Around 150 people volunteered. This, of course, freaked the British jailing authorities out. That they started thinking, all these people are going to starve themselves to death? I mean, what are we going to do? The prisoners, because the prisoners were already talking about starving themselves to death, they were led, as I said, by Brendan Hughes. The strike was joined by several women in the women's prison in Armagh. They started a hunger strike in sympathy with the male hunger strikers. And the British authorities, again, were looking at it saying, we're going to have women starving themselves to death. I mean, they were really, it was pretty, you know, obviously an extraordinarily difficult situation. Several dozen people went on strike for a while, but the focus was on these seven. The strike went on for 53 days. At the brink of death, the leader, Hughes, called it off. He didn't want them to die. They were all mostly young people, and he stopped it after 53 days. Which, in other words, you know what these people must have looked like with just water and salt. That's all they took for 53 days. they were still, it was amazing they were still alive. The prison authorities who were actually at the prison, they tried to compromise with them at this point and said, well, look, we'll let you wear what, you know, sort of these sort of generic civilian clothes that we give to people in certain statuses, and you don't have to wear what the criminals wear. And they said, no. They said, we're going to continue striking until we get to where we get back to what we had before, and before 1976, and you treat us as full political prisoners. So they refused to compromise. And naturally, these prison authorities, incidentally, were completely freaked out by this. The people who were actually working at the prison, they were really, really sort of thinking, okay, where is this going? I mean, you know, how are we going to deal with this? There would seem to be no easy way to deal with it. Yeah. So they continued, to try to sort of reach the, you know, they offered several compromises, but the prisoners said no, they weren't going to compromise. And it was clear by the size of the number who volunteered, by the nature of what happened, that some of these people wanted to martyr themselves for their cause, to make their purpose. They were trying to make the statement of, I'm willing to starve myself to death because I think you're wrong. I think you're immoral. What the way you, you know, the way you are in Ireland, your presence in Ireland, how you treat us. So in that basically carried that crisis carried through 1980. At the end of 1980, another group of prisoners in the maze began talking about going on strike. They were led by this fellow, Bobby Sands. Amazingly, all these guys who go on strike and die, they're all in their 20s.
Brendan, was the press paying more attention to this now than they were to the?
Yeah, they realized that there was a crisis in the system, and they realized that you know, there seemed to be, because the British government and then Thatcher didn't want to be shown as being, you know, soft on terrorism, of stepping back to people that she had labeled terrorists, you know, in other words, giving in to them. It created a situation where the prisoners who believed in the Republican cause were unwilling to compromise, and they had a government that was unwilling to try to reach them in a meaningful way. And so you got into a situation where there was no easy compromise.
Was the opposition using this, trying to use this against Thatcher at this point, or was the government more or less aligned?
I think that most of the government was aligned, and that they saw this as an attempt of what they called terrorists. You know, in other words, that's how they labeled those. One of the things that really becomes disturbing about Thatcher, and in fact has and continued to this day, is how little most British politicians know about Ireland or Northern Ireland. They don't know much about it. Thatcher, I don't think, knew much about it. I don't think Boris Johnson knows much about it. They can't figure out what the issues are there. They don't understand the history of Ireland. And that's part of the problem, too. They didn't realize the depth of commitment of these people. And so they thought, well, they'll give in. And they didn't want to give in. In February of 1981, Bobby Sands, who was a leader of the Provo prisoners in the maze, he had one time been the sort of captain of all the prisoners. He declared his intention to go on hunger strike. He was 26 at the time he declared that, and 27 at the time he died. He had been born in Belfast in 1954. He had been a Provo since 1972, the year of crisis, which you talked about in the earlier episode. Sands began his strike on March 1st. He was determined to assert that he was a political prisoner, and he set out with the determination to show, I'm willing to starve myself to death to show that we're stronger than them, psychologically and morally. He'd been arrested on a gun charge. It also involved a bombing in 1976. He had been one of the dirty protesters, so he had already been part of the movement, so to speak, part of this whole system of protest. There were some protests in support of him, but the whole thing began to take off and become a global issue, which you must remember this, right, from when you were a kid. I mean, of course, we followed it very closely at my home. I was living in Oregon. I was living in Oregon at the time, but we talked about it every week on the phone with my parents. There were some protests in support of him, but what happened is that one of the members of parliament from a Republican area in the north of Ireland, but he was a Republican sympathizer, this guy, but he wasn't a member of the Sinn Féin or the IRA because they didn't take their seats, but he was actually in parliament. He died at the beginning of this protest, and Sands decided to stand for his district as a member of parliament.
While he was in turn.
While he was starving himself.
Yep.
While he was already on the hunger strike.
Yep.
The people in that area, they rallied to really, a lot of people came out to fight for him as a political leader. because they thought, well, if he gets elected, they're not going to let a sitting member, elected member of parliament starve to death. They'll make these concessions. And then these young guys, he was young. He was a kid, really. I mean, to do this, it was the sitting person had died. In other words, Sands was elected to the British Commons in early April. The hunger strike became a global.
So he won the election.
He won the election.
As a hunger striker.
As a hunger striker, yeah. One of the ways, incidentally, apparently, which I remember my father telling me this at the time, I don't know how he knew this, but later on it became current. Several other people who were interested in republicanism, like Bernadette Devlin and the brother of the guy who had died, and several other people were thinking, well, maybe I should stand, you know, too, in this. And apparently members of the provost had a chat with them about their electoral futures if they didn't clear the deck for Sands to run against the guy from the UUP. Mm-hmm. They cleared out the opposition, and Sands won, and it became a sensation. It was used to pressure Margaret Thatcher. Pressure began to come in from around the world about what was going on. It was so intense, I think, the pressure and the press. While that was going on, by then, other guys, they had planned it, unlike in the earlier hunger strikes where they all went on hunger strike together. In this strike, they were basically spacing out people joining the strike every 2 weeks or every staggered. Sort of 10, staggered, right, spreading it out, a staggered joining of the strike. Other people had already begun to join the strike, and they were also not giving in. So they basically started, as he was elected, other people were already joining the strike. One by one, these young guys.
The idea being that you're going to have a string of deaths on your hand. It's not going to be one event. It's going to be a series of events.
It's going to go on for months.
Yeah,
it's not going to be over at one point and then say, well, okay, right, that was over. Yep. It's going to go on and on and on. They really had a kind of, you know, it became a meltdown in some sense. Some people tried to get him to end the strike. And the Pope sent a papal envoy, a special envoy, to the prison to try to talk them down, to try to get them, you know, to say, okay, look, we'll try to work with you diplomatically. And he said, no, I won't. I won't. He would not back down or give up. On May 5th, he died. He became a huge martyr, of course, in the Republican cause, and also among all nationalists, regardless of their sort of, you know, there are many different sort of people among many Catholics. There was deep resentment. There was widespread rioting across the North. There were sympathy protests in Europe. There was a lot of unrest in Dublin. His funeral, which was obviously a political funeral, drew over 100,000 people. And they actually, the IRA guys came out and were in their uniforms, in military uniforms with him. The British government was afraid to do anything about it. They couldn't intervene and, you know, arrest them because they feared there's 100,000 people out there. It's an army, right, in the street.
Right.
But protests broke out even in places like in northern Italy, in India, or, you know, the Indian government. People expressed sympathy with him. By that point, there were a number of other people already starting to join the strike and preparing to join the strike. They were as, in many respects, as committed as he was. We're going to talk about the continuation of the strike and how it leads, where it leads in terms of the crisis in Ireland. We'll be right back with the historians.
This is Mike Janity. Join me every Thursday afternoon between 12 noon and 2 o'clock for our Cape Cod Happy Hour Party, featuring all of your favorite party and sing-along songs from the 60s, 70s, and 80s right here on WNTN 1550 AM and WNTN.com.
There's an old New England saying for just about everything in life, but our favorite is this one. Use only the finest 100% Arabica beans. We're the New England Coffee Company, and we've been perfecting the art of coffee roasting for over 85 years. All that experience has created a reputation for exceptional coffee, so that every cup is rich, satisfying, delicious, in the New England tradition. New England Coffee, available at your local supermarket.
All right, we're back with the historians. It's a very sobering episode of the historians talking about the hunger strikes in Northern Ireland. But we will take a break from that sad story for just a moment to welcome back one of our historical sponsors, Brendan. You know, as we move out of the pandemic and people begin to think not only about social distancing, but about just being social, you know, Brendan, people are going to have parties. I know you were a big, you had a very busy social calendar in the time before the pandemic, Brendan.
Oh, I certainly did. Yes. I mean,
the opera, and, you know, there were many social engagements, you know, I was always impressed with this. But you know what surveys show to be the main reason Americans dislike throwing parties?
No.
Cleanup, you know, balloon costs, litigation. Well, the our historical sponsor today has taken all that into consideration. It's Soviet party planning. You probably remember them. I mean, the difficulty of planning is overwhelming, from the guest list to menus to activities for kids who always show up uninvited. Have you noticed that people will show up at an adult party with their kids, you know, and look at it like, what's it? Or bring their pets, you know, at the party.
Their dog. Yes, I noticed that.
Okay, so making plans for a party is a time-consuming and psychologically stressful activity. But our sponsor, Soviet Party Planning, is ready to step into the breach of this entertaining Kalashnikov and help you make your next party the dominant and hegemonic event in the neighborhood. Founded in Leningrad, that is St. Petersburg, in 1991, by a group of experienced but suddenly unemployed apparatchiks, Soviet party planning spread quickly to socially active countries both east and west of the Urals, especially Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. But now it's headquartered in, you want to guess?
No.
Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, well, where else?
Yeah. Soviet Party Planning U.S. works hard to ensure the success of your next major socialist, social or socio-political event. And beyond the run-of-the-mill services like help with decorations, invitations, and vodka selection, Soviet Party Planning offers amenities and services you just won't find with your average event planning agency, including advanced drone-based surveillance, guerrilla advertising, wiretapping, and internet scrubs for those embarrassing or incriminating YouTube videos, tweets, and Instagram photos that can spoil any event after the fact. So contact Soviet Party Planning by emailing yourfriendvlad@kgb.ussr.gov and make all your entertaining revolutionary.
Soviet Party Planning, when you need to see your comrades.
See your comrades, you certainly do. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's. I don't think we're having any parties.
Nobody was having any parties. No,
nobody's having any parties while these guys are on their hunger, and women are involved in these hunger strikes.
The women weren't striking at this point. That had been earlier, but they were no longer continuing their strike. But the men were striking, and one after another, they joined. Francis Hughes joined on March 15th. A guy named Raymond McCreesh joined on March 22nd. They were all in their 20s. They were either provosts or members of the INLA.
I'm struck by the fact, Brendan, that the papal envoy didn't have any effect with them, which takes this completely out of the realm of not completely out, but out of the realm of a Catholic versus Protestant thing. I mean, it's a political, of course, there's a religious element. I understand it, a very important religious element. But if you're Catholic and you're fighting for Catholicism, but the Pope can't step in, you know, that says something.
They're fighting for many of the people who were leaders in the IRA. As I said, they were closely connected to the Catholic communities, but their own views were mixed and sometimes about religion. And also, just because the Pope's envoy asks you to do something doesn't mean you're going to do it. I did want to say Bobby Sands, Francis Hughes, Raymond McCreesh, Patsy O'Hara, Joe McConnell, Martin Harson, Kevin Lynch, Kiernan Doherty, Thomas McGill, and Michael Devine. One after another, they went on hunger strike and starved themselves to death.
Wow.
Yeah. One after another. They died between May 5th, when Bobby Sands died, to August 20th. So it went on that whole summer. Some families had asked for their members to be removed from the hunger strike, which is why people stopped joining. There were 13 other people on the ready to join or beginning to join the strike. And in some cases, the family said, please, you know, don't let them starve themselves to death. I was in New Jersey that summer, and you could see, I mean, Irish Americans, it's a conservative community. Irish Americans were aghast that this has been allowed to go on, you know, at the British government. It's where the British government really, not that they weren't always sympathetic. They were sympathetic to Irish nationalism and Irish republicanism. But of course, it was ambiguous in some respects because of the nature of what had happened with the violence and, you know, civilians being killed, innocent people being killed by all parties, of course. And I think that this hunger strike changed Irish Americans and made them far more sympathetic to the provost position. And I can remember people saying things to me at the time, mm-hmm. you know, who are Irish American type people. You could see that it had really turned. This really changed their view of, you know, in other words, the British government letting these people die.
So, Brendan, you said you were in Oregon at this point.
No, I was back in New Jersey during the summer when this happened. Okay. After, you know, at the end of the term. So I returned to New Jersey at that time, and I do remember that. Most people stopped joining after June 22nd. 1981, pardon me, they stopped joining. During the strike, also, though, the provost and the INLA had begun shooting prison guards and officials, as well as members of the British Army in retaliation, and police in retaliation for what was going on in the prison.
Assassinating them,
yes. Right. They were going after those people. In response, incidentally, they loyalist paramilitaries began shooting Republicans, one of whom, Bernadette Devlin, at that point, she was married. Her and her husband were shot. She was shot 9 times, but survived it.
Good heavens.
They broke in. Now, at that point, in that incident involving Bernadette Devlin, she was supposed to have been being protected by the British Army because they knew she was a target. And yet, nonetheless, even though supposedly these British soldiers were on guard outside of her home, the loyalist paramilitaries got into her place and shot her in front of her children.
So this looks suspicious.
To say the least.
Yeah.
And the British military lost it any kind of sense of that, you know, people saw them as having taken, right. you know, aside. Even it, right. Even though she wasn't a member of the provost, she was just she was an Irish Republican, but yeah. not, she was sympathetic. She wasn't an actual member. She was shot 9 times. Global reaction was strong. People began really to denounce it. The Catholic Church, the English Catholic Church, of course, denounced the hunger strikers, but the Catholic Church overall was much more sympathetic to them. In other words, they saw them as, you know, martyrs for a cause they believed just. That's how they described them. People began to once again pour into the provost. They again had more people than they could handle yeah. in terms of membership, and into the INLA, which of course that was a dangerous group for sure. Feelings towards Margaret Thatcher were ferocious. I mean, people really resented her. They saw her as the epitome of sort of callous British indifference to everything that happens in Ireland, you know, and
even though these policies weren't hers, she was continuing the policy of the previous regime. It was her unwillingness to compromise that.
Right. I mean, at one point she said in public, well, Bobby Sands, you know, was a terrorist and killed himself. And that's more than his victims. You know, the victims of the provost ever got their choice. That didn't go over with people. People began to pour into the IRA and the INLA, as I said. The fallout to this, in many respects, with the violence raging, and there was rioting in the streets naturally at each death, and this had continued, unrest had continued into 1982. In 1983, with the violence continuing to rage, a large cohort of prisoners in the maze, 38 in all, they staged a prison break. They were able to somehow smuggle guns in. They got six or seven handguns into the maze. They also made their own weapons. They took a bunch of people prisoner and they got their uniforms. And then
did anybody have a birthday and there were some big cakes brought in for the, what, is this a cartoon prison? Right. I mean,
it was supposedly the most secure prison in Europe.
Yeah, supposedly.
Well, one of the things is that they were tightly organized, and that was to their advantage. They were together, largely provost. I think a few INLA guys were in there, but almost all were provosts, you know, in with this prison break. 38 of them, they were able to then hijack the food delivery truck. They put the 37 guys in the truck.
37 guys in one truck. Were they all dressed in clown costumes? I mean,
well, no, a lot of them were dressed in prison uniform, you know, in other words, the uniform of the prison guards, because they had taken them hostage and put them in one part sealed them up. So then when they drove the thing to the main gate, which they couldn't get open, and like seven or eight of them jumped out and they went to like the main guard tower and were looking for an opportunity to get the gate open so they could get the truck through the gate. They took a bunch of guys who were coming in on a shift change, prisoner. They were doing a, you know, they basically, but a lot of them, they ultimately, they broke out. Some of them were recaptured immediately, but some of them escaped into the Irish Republic or other parts of Europe.
And were never captured.
And were never brought back.
Oh my goodness.
They escaped. But of course, wow, a lot of them went right back to working for the provost, you know, either abroad or in Ireland or a lot of them got into the Republic and then were, so anyway, wow, that prison break became known as the Great Escape.
Like I was about to say, it sounds like the movie The Great Escape, except everybody gets pretty much recaptured.
Well, they recaptured in that movie, but not everyone got recaptured in 1983.
Right. I think one person gets away in The Great Escape.
They seize control of a section of the prison, and then they seize control of this gate area, and they escape. That has been made, the whole story is very sort of complicated. It's been made into several movies. There have been several movies about it made in Europe. The British began at that point to use the SAS, their special sort of their equivalent of Delta Force or the Navy SEALs, in targeted assassinations of provosts in Ireland. Wow. That had been going on, but they intensified it. Some of the escapees were killed by them while on the run. In sort of late in the months that followed, they were killed by them. This all then sort of culminated in this period of turmoil from 80 to 84, with the fighting, rioting, and unrest, and assassination, and arson still raging in the north. The provost decided to try to decapitate the entire British government by killing Margaret Thatcher and her entire cabinet. How did they do this? The British Conservative Party had announced it would have its yearly convention in a hotel in Brighton, in Sussex, in England. I think it's County Sussex. The provost had one of their members check in like a month or 6 weeks before, take up the floor of the bathroom of the room he was staying in and build a bomb inside the bathroom and then replace the floor, you know, put the floorboards back.
Right.
On a long-term, I assume that was on a long-term timer. I assume that's how they triggered it, on a long-term timer. I don't know exactly how they triggered that, but they triggered it with the knowledge that Margaret Thatcher would be staying in that hotel. Again, you can go online and see the film of what that hotel looked like and how big that bomb had to be and how powerful a bomb it had to be. They were going to decapitate the entire conservative, basically the Conservative Party leadership, which at that point was the British national leadership. They had stayed in the hotel. They ripped up the floorboard. I believe that was Patrick McGee, who's the guy's name was. I was trying to remember that today, and I believe it was Patrick McGee. Then they sealed it back off. The bomb went off on October 12th, 1984, with Thatcher and most of the Conservative Party in the hotel.
But did it kill anybody?
Yeah, it killed five people, including a Conservative member of Parliament. Several other officials were killed. 35 people were injured. Thatcher escaped largely unscathed, but it was only because she had moved from one room to another, in other words, when the bomb went off. The provost took immediate responsibility and said, Margaret Thatcher was lucky today, but we only have to be lucky once. We intend to kill her.
Wow.
So they really did. It was like a real declaration of war. Wow. Against the top of the British government. We are coming up on our final break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Welcome to our neighborhood. Our family has been doing business here since 1914. That's our tradition, and that's why we call ourselves Old Neighborhood Foods, bringing you the finest deli meats for over 100 years, all crafted from our family recipes with the finest ingredients, with no MSG, gluten, or trans fats. That's the old-fashioned way. Old Neighborhood, a family legacy of quality and taste.
Old Neighborhood quality meats and cold cuts, available in the deli cases of all Demoulas Market Baskets and wholesale for restaurants, pizza shops, and delis through Costa's Provisions. Old Neighborhood, Palia Gitonia, a family business owned and operated by the Demakis family since 1914.
Hi, this is Mike DeStacio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550. And you can also stream us worldwide at wntn1550am.com.
You can climb a mountain.
right, we're back. We're the Historians. For information on the Historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at therealhistorians@gmail.com. Wow. A bomb goes off. It killed a member of Parliament, injured several other people, but Margaret Thatcher escaped. The rest of the cabinet escaped, but the provost said, we're not giving up.
We're not giving up.
Yeah, wow.
The fighting continued. I was living in Dublin in the middle of the beginning in 1985 and 1986, right before I met you. I was living in Dublin at that time. During my time there, the British authorities tried to extradite a woman named Evelyn Glenn Holmes from Dublin, who had been involved in the bombing and shooting campaign in 1981. On the British mainland. In other words, as this was going on, they also began another bombing and shooting campaign primarily bombing in Great Britain, in England. They attempted to arrest her. It became a kind of confused scene. At one point, gunshots were fired, although I didn't know that. And I was walking down the main street of Dublin at the time this was going on, and you could see this large swelling crowd forming, which was involved in this, in her sort of complicated escape. But you could feel underneath the surface, as a person who was living there, people were quite polite. And often if this issue came up, particularly as a foreigner, even though as an Irish American, they see you as an American, obviously. People would not take, would speak very generally about it. But when you got to know people over time, mm-hmm. it would eventually come out, look what they're doing up there. It's too much. I mean, it's this whole situation. And one of the reasons why they could not extradite this woman, Evelyn Glenn Holmes, who ended up being driven away with members of Sinn Féin and the provost in the car from her, even though the British police were there to try to extradite her, because the Irish government and the British police in the end feared that if we grab her and try to drag her back to the court, it was very complicated. What happened to her, sort of very muddled, will be attacked by the crowd and killed. Or we'll have to shoot people, and then it'll escalate, and there'll be more violence in Dublin. This was, mm-hmm. but you could see beneath the surface, there was
right.
tremendous resentment over the conditions in Northern Ireland and what was right. had been done to the Catholics, and this was in part in the aftermath of the hunger strike. It was part of the aftermath of what had happened in the hunger strike, which becomes a kind of breaking point for people. I do think there's something to that. In the next episode, the final episode, we'll talk about how they go from this chronic situation of violence and retribution and the kind of back and forth to a situation where they can get to a peaceful accord. And that is a 12-year process from 85, basically, to 97, 98.
Well, I will be very thankful. It's a terrible story. You said today we were going to reach the low point. So
would you say that was a fair evaluation?
Yes, it certainly was. I was not prepared for exactly how low we were going to go, even having lived through, the news reports of this. But I'm glad we're ending today's with a little glimmer of hope for our final episode on the.
There's a lot of material online about the hunger strikes. I urge people to go online on YouTube and look at this situation. It really is. It's almost too much to take.
I watched what you sent me this week, and it was very.
It's a lot to take.
Yep.
We'll stop there, and we will return. We will now turn to our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News. It will definitely be my favorite segment today, because I hope there will be a little bit of good news in This Week in Historical News, but I fear you are beginning with obituaries.
Obituaries. Prince Philip has died. We talked about that on the other show as well. In many ways, a quite interesting man. Obviously, he said some things that were not appropriate. That was his nature. He spoke quite openly about certain things, and some things about his feelings and were quite antiquated and inappropriate. That is true. Some of his language. He was, as I noted on the other show, on our Friday afternoon show, he was a person who had served heroically in World War II. He had interest in the environment. He was a man of his times. And as I said, some of the things he said, are not pleasant necessarily.
So our listener understands. We've been appearing on Fridays at 11 with our boss, Ted Dimitriades.
Right.
Talking about the week's news. And so that's what you mean by it.
That's what I mean by it, yes. And
we did talk about Prince Philip's death.
We did talk about Prince Philip's death. I also want to mention the death of a man named Ray Lambert. He was a survivor of the first wave on Omaha Beach on D-Day. He was 100 years old. He won 2 Silver Stars and I believe three Purple Hearts and 2 Silver Stars. He was also involved in the invasion of North Africa and Sicily. He was a medic under fire during D-Day. He saved the lives, pulling people out of the surf who had been wounded. He was honored by President Trump. At one point in the honoring him, President Trump, when President Trump spoke about him, he turned to him. He turned to him and said, "At the end of it, Ray, the free people of the world salute you," which is appropriate given what he sacrificed during that time when he was on D-Day. He was shot several times and he had a broken back, a fractured vertebrae, and still continued to pull people out of the surf. He was a medic, as I said, still continued to pull people out of the surf. Joy Hummel has died. Who is she? She is the she was a woman. She wrote, she basically did the dialogue for the first Wonder Woman comics. She was one of those, that generation of great women comics and science fiction writers. Yeah, fantastic.
Was Wonder Woman known for particularly good dialogue? I didn't realize that.
Well, you know, that it's sort of interesting, though, because there was this entire great generation of women science fiction writers and women comic book writers or comic.
I did not know that. I knew Fontana for Star Trek. That's about it.
Right. No, but there was a whole group of others that are the sort of the first generation of women writers. She's passed away at a good old age at 97. And, you know, it really is fabulous. And the obituary, which appeared in the Boston Globe, described how she got involved with writing these comics, just like DC Fontana got involved, sort of got hired as a secretary. And then someone realized, hey, this person hasn't got a lot of talent. So they began to use her. Bernie Madoff has died.
I saw that.
The greatest schemer in the history of humanity. The greatest Ponzi schemer in the history of humanity.
With the perfect last name, Madoff, which Madoff. Is exactly what he did. He made off with your money.
all kinds of people suffered because of him. All kinds of people lost their money. Really was a kind of tragic thing for many of them. It was a tremendous scandal and basically just a disaster, right? I mean, there's no other way to describe it. Northern Ireland. There's been rioting for the last 9-10 days.
I've had a feeling this was going to come up.
Right. It's related to Brexit because the border has been drawn in the Irish Sea in regard to goods rather than on the Irish mainland. In other words, on the island of Ireland, in order to preserve the sort of spirit of the Good Friday Agreement when they were all in the EU together. It also is related to two other things. There was a Republican funeral that drew large numbers of people. It was the funeral of Bobby Storey, the leader of the prisoners who broke out of the H block in 1983.
Wow.
In today's episode. Wow. He died about 6 weeks ago, and the Sinn Féin leadership and others sort of violated the COVID restrictions. It was a massive political funeral for the guy, including the leader, Mary MacDonald, the leader of Sinn Féin in the South, came, and all kinds of different leaders of the Irish Republican and Nationalist movement came to this. And the unionists resented this because no one was prosecuted for violating the rules about mass gatherings and stuff. So they became indignant. But some people also think that this violence is tied to the future, the coming census. The coming demographic, you know, looks at the demographics of Northern Ireland. They think in this census that it's going to show that the Catholics are now the largest group.
Mm-hmm.
And the Protestants are frightened of this. And the Protestants are no longer an absolute majority anyway. But now it looks like the Catholics will be the largest group.
Brendan, wasn't there, didn't the unionist group stage one of these marches too, one of these parades?
They staged a parade. There's been stealing buses, burning vehicles, rioting, trying to provoke the Catholics into the rioting. But what's interesting about this is that Sinn Féin is telling the Catholics, don't respond to this because they're playing right into our hands by showing themselves to be the aggressor.
Right. Well, thank God that they're seeing that.
Right. They're playing right into our hands politically.
Yeah.
Also, they're calling in the open, particularly in the South, in Dublin, the Sinn Féin leadership is calling for a border poll within the next few years, next four or five years. In other words, a poll on whether you want to join Ireland or stay in Great Britain. And of course, these unionists are hearing this and they're completely losing it.
Well, my first reaction when this parade thing, you and I discussed this a couple of days ago, like, are you serious? They're doing these paramilitary parades again? I mean, you talk about bad memories. Yeah.
They do them every July.
And so, plus, the whole thing is irrational. The unionists are protesting against being cut off from the British government. The British government proposed and supports the Brexit agreement that created this situation. They're protesting essentially against a phantom that doesn't exist. I don't know.
I saw a tape. It was this TV show in the South, and the host was talking to a member, Mary McDonald, the head of Sinn Féin, and Mary Lou McDonald, pardon me, and a fellow from the Democratic Unionist Party, the party of Ian Paisley, and he was saying, we're never going to have a border poll, we're never going to, and the other people in the panel were saying, your party agreed to this.
Exactly. It's not the Catholics and the Irish nationalists that created this problem. It's the very people in England that you somehow want to be joined to. But they're the ones who made the issue. I don't know.
Right. In other words, what we talked about today, and in which some respects, in many respects, this episode on the hunger strike was truncated. There was much more involved. At one point, Gerry Adams had tried to intervene in the hunger strike, and the hunger strikers tell him, no. We won't go on. We're not going to abandon this. Bobby Sands died for us. We're ready to die for him. I mean, and this emotions are now still raw this many years later. I mean, you're talking about 40 years later, the emotions are still at the surface. I want to now turn over to China. China has now launched a hotline for citizens to report illegal comments about history, the history of China and the Chinese Communist Party.
Illicit history hotline from the Chinese Communist Party.
Pardon me. This is from Reuters.
Bless you.
Supposed to be able to turn in anybody who is defaming the Chinese Communist Party or by talking about alternate history, what the party now calls historical nihilism.
Yep. The amazing thing was that they were flooded with calls from American university campuses.
Right. Right. I would also note, yeah, of course, right. The American University, there's somehow a convergence there. I would also note that the Chinese government is taken down or manipulating the last sort of liberal Chinese platform on the net that promotes Western ideas about feminism. They are forcing them to stop or remove articles concerning Western feminism, in part because the articles encourage people not to marry and have children, which, of course, then feeds into the Chinese demographic issue.
Wow.
They are opposed to that and have taken those things down. There's also been developments on what we covered last week in terms of our East African update. Egypt and Sudan are doing joint military exercises over the Nile with their air force. Obviously, this is meant to threaten Ethiopia in regard to the dam. And the Egyptians have now launched a massive diplomatic campaign. Remember, we had talked offline about talking to the people in Uganda. Also, now they're reaching out to Tunisia, and they're reaching out. The Russians have become involved, which, of course, both Egypt and Ethiopia are long-term interests of the Russians going back before the Soviet era. So you've really got a kind of complex situation. But I don't want to end there, and I did want to bring up one thing that sort of puts all these global problems and crises into perspective. The crisis of the British Garden is back.
Thankfully.
There has now been a battle has broken out over at Cambridge University. Thank goodness it's not Oxford, Robin. Robin Lane Fox at Cambridge over whether they should continue to have lawns or turn the lawns into rewilded meadows that will be suitable for English invertebrates, butterflies and insects. This has turned into a huge crisis. It's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday, April 14th.
When you mentioned English invertebrates, I thought you meant members of parliament.
The crisis in the British Garden. The historians are on it. We are up on the end of the show. We will be back next week. We're the historians. Thank you.